Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The Presidencies of the United States is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. Hello and welcome to the Presidencies of the United States. I'm your host, Jerry Landry. As this is an episode of the Seat at the Table special series where we talk about the life and career of a cabinet member, I am joined by a special guest, and it is a very special guest, my dear friend Alicia from Civics and Coffee. Alicia, how are you doing today?
Hi, Jerry. I'm great. I'm so happy to be here.
So glad to have you here. This is actually your third appearance on the Seat at the Table series. You helped us to get things started off with a guy that folks may have heard about, Alexander Hamilton. He's one of those lesser known figures of history.
Yeah, he really needs to be studied more. I mean, I feel like somebody could maybe, I don't know, create a musical about his life.
Maybe somebody will get to that one of these days. You know, we'll have to wait and see. But yep. In the meantime, thank you so much for being here. Always a pleasure to talk with you. We have such great conversations, and I think we're going to have another one today because we've got a very fascinating cabinet member to talk about.
Indeed.
But before we get started, I'd like to give you an opportunity for any of our listeners who have not come upon Civics and Coffee yet. Just please, if you take a moment to tell us about Civics and Coffee and where folks can find you.
Absolutely. Well, again, thanks for having me on for yet another one of these. I always love our conversations. And as you know, because you listen, because you're such a wonderful friend and fan, I'm always talking about how much I love presidencies. And I'm always excited to see what other episodes you come up with. But so Civics and Coffee, it is a short form podcast. So whereas you go into wonderful deep dives and you really analyze and contextualize, I think, these great men in history and their administrations. I try to take those big narratives and clip them down into really short segments. So my elevator pitch, as it were, is history and the time it takes you to drink a cup of coffee. So I cover events, people, and themes throughout American history, starting at the quote-unquote beginning of 1492. I know that that's not necessarily the beginning, but it's where I start. And yeah, I mix it up a little bit between listener requests. So as people come and say, hey, I've always wanted to know about the World's Fair, for example. That was a really fun series to put together. But otherwise, I follow a linear timeline, and I've begun incorporating historian guests and public historians onto the show to talk about all facets of history, because I really want to get adults and anybody who thinks they might not be a history lover into the history game, because I firmly believe that everybody is deep down secretly a history lover. You just haven't found your niche yet.
Absolutely. And there is so much history to explore. There's something for everybody. There's something for everybody to get connected to.
Absolutely.
And Alex and I were just listening while we were having our coffee this morning to your latest episode, which was on the Winchester House, which amazing. And that's what I love about your podcast, Alicia. You find these points in history that folks may not know much about, or in this case, that there's so much misconceptions about. And in that time it takes to have a cup of coffee, you do break it down. You know, it takes me a while to get there, but you're much more succinct than I to get to the point of, you know, what we need to know about these points in history. And that was a particularly fascinating one. I highly recommend anybody who hasn't listened to it yet to go and check it out.
Well, thank you so much. I love hearing that. And if I could pique people's interest, then I feel like I've done my job. I really want people to, at the end of the episode, go, wow, I didn't know that. I want to know more.
Absolutely. And Alex is somebody, you know, he's over the years, he's been subjected to hearing me talk about history so much. And at the end of it, he was saying just that. He was like, oh, That's interesting. I'd like to know more about that. So
yes,
next time we're on the West Coast, I think we're going to have to pay a visit.
Oh, yes.
Well, Alicia, we are going to dive into the history of Richard Rush. And yes. I shared a little bit with you about him prior to recording. But before that, had you heard of Richard Rush?
In putting together prior episodes of, you know, different military battles and then different presidential administrations, I have definitely come across the name Richard Rush, but definitely only a peripheral view of him. I think I probably know more about his father than I do about him. So I'm really, really excited to dive into him and learn and at the end, make a little judgment.
We will definitely have much to discuss. But a point that you just brought up, we're going to get to very quickly. But one thing I did want to note before we get started is that Richard Rush has the distinction of being the first cabinet member covered in the series who was born after the Revolutionary War began.
Oh, wow.
So we're starting to make that transition to another generation of American leaders. And so it's fascinating to be here.
Yes, indeed.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.
And like you said, Alicia, so his father is somebody who folks may know more about, Dr. Benjamin Rush. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, as was his grandfather, Richard Stockton. So two signers of the Declaration in his family. So Richard was born as the third child of Benjamin Rush and Julia Stockton in Philadelphia on August 29th, 1780. Benjamin and Julia would ultimately have 13 children total. Yeah, that's a lot of kids.
Oh, yeah. I know it was common during the time because of, you know, losing a lot of children, but it's still every time I hear it, I'm always like, oh, that's a lot.
And good thing he was a doctor. So, although doctor at this point is, I believe it was with Kenny that I was talking with. And he was like, yeah, doctor, you need to put that in air quotes. When you're applying leeches and things like that, it's, are you
yeah.
really? But in addition to being a patriot leader during the Revolution, Dr. Benjamin Rush was also a physician and engaged in various humanitarian causes and would bestow upon his children, Richard included, a sense of civic duty. Now, I couldn't find much on Richard's early education, but on both sides of the family, there was a tradition of the men in the family going to the College of New Jersey in Princeton. And so we've had numerous folks on the series who have ended up at that same institution. Richard would follow this tradition. He became the third generation of his family to go to Princeton in 1794. But rather than stay in a dormitory while in college, Richard lived with his maternal grandmother. As described by his biographer, J.H. Powell, quote, at the college, Richard made no particular mark for brilliance, but he did win prominence in debating clubs, which, of course, is always a good preparation for a life in public service and in politics. Rush graduated from college in 1797 and returned to Philadelphia to begin legal studies under William Lewis, a noted attorney in the city. So here we go. Another lawyer. We've come across many of these over the course of these episodes.
And yes, a very consistent theme.
Yes. And Rush began his legal career in 1800 when he was admitted to the bar and opened his own law practice. However, as young men throughout history are sometimes wont to do, Rush wasn't ready to settle down just yet. And having a father who knew many of the leading figures from the Revolution might just help to make some ambitions come true. Thus, Dr. Richard Rush reached out to his old friend, Secretary of State James Madison, to see if a posting abroad might be made available for his son, Richard. It's always convenient when you're friends with the Secretary of State.
Ah, nepotism at its finest.
I know, right? Now, in this case, it actually didn't work out. He would have to wait a bit longer to travel beyond the U.S. Thus, as noted by Powell, quote, Rush began a period of 6 years diligent study of literature, history, oratory, government, and law. But he's starting to get his name out there and starting to have people in, you know, prominent national leaders know he's interested in something more. And we'll come back to that. But in 1803 and 1804, a couple of short essays that Richard wrote were published in the Philadelphia Portfolio. And Powell asserts that, quote, he, i.e. Rush, was apparently contemplating a career of literary endeavor, but it was interrupted by mundane things. Mundane things such as political matters. And though he had begun with Federalist inklings, as his father was a prominent Democratic Republican, Richard was increasingly drawn to that side of the aisle, and by 1807, Richard was speaking at party meetings in Philadelphia. It was during this time that Rush developed his friendship and political alliance with John Benz, who was a publisher who established the Democratic Press, which was to be, quote, the organ for the next half century of the Philadelphia Democratic Party, in opposition to William Duane's Philadelphia Aurora, which, though also a Democratic-Republican publication, was in opposition to the likes of James Madison and Albert Gallatin. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to see, and we've talked about this in the Madison presidency series, and we saw the beginnings of it with Jefferson, you know, in the Democratic-Republican Party, they're starting to form these factions within the party. And so he's aligning more with the pro-administration faction versus these, you know, they're called old Republicans or the Invisibles. So it's, he's starting to have that political alignment with the establishment. In an early sign of what was to come, Rush would actually serve as Duane's legal defense when Pennsylvania's governor, Thomas McKean, sued Duane for libel in 1808. Rush's arguments in a four-hour oration helped to establish his reputation as a litigator. While Duane's faction of the party asked Rush afterward to run for Congress, he declined that offer. Instead, he focused on other civic engagement work, as well as a bit of personal business, as Rush was ready to start a family of his own. So in the fall,
Oh, no, I was just thinking, yes, of course he would pause on the public service, because this was still a time period where congressmen and representatives weren't really well paid. So if he was thinking about getting married, he was like, no, I'm going to keep my practice. Thanks, though.
I may need my practice and maybe a couple of other jobs closer to home. But yeah. So in the fall of 1809, Richard Rush married Catherine Elizabeth Murray of Maryland. As described by Rush's biographer Powell, quote, she was a beautiful woman, intelligent and lively. Between them existed a tender relationship, which was a never-failing inspiration to Richard. His letters to her when they were separated are affectionate and gay. They reveal him at his best. And Rush once said that, quote, I began the world in good earnest when I married.
Aw, that's so sweet.
And it's one of those things, you know, we have so many relationships that we've seen in this podcast. And it's like, okay, well, we assume things are going well. We don't really know, but it's nice and refreshing to hear, you know, this actually is, seems like it was a love match.
Yeah.
Aww. The newlyweds moved next door to Richard's parents in Philadelphia, which, you know, hopefully she got along with the in-laws well, because otherwise that would not be a good arrangement. But in these early days, and to your point, Alicia, the Rushes struggled financially. Yeah. Richard had come into the marriage $600 in debt and had had to borrow money to furnish their new house. Their first child, a son named Benjamin after Richard's father, was born in early 1811. But as their family was growing, so too were Richard's prospects as a public servant, because Pennsylvania Governor Simon Schneider appointed Richard Rush as the state's attorney general in February 1811. This new post offered, quote, with salary and perquisites, the opportunity for Rush to make more than $100 a month to add to his private income. Again, trying to find those side gigs that will bring in a little more money for this growing family.
The original side hustles.
Exactly. You know, side hustle of state attorney general. You know, it happens all the time.
It's not a full-time gig. It's fine.
Exactly. It's fine. Now, though Dr. Rush, Richard's father, did not support Schneider, Richard did agree to take up the post and indeed, quote, looked upon Schneider as the leader of a new, attractive movement in politics. Richard threw himself into the work and, quote, by fall, he had cleared the docket of all arrears of business in spite of the chaotic conditions of the Pennsylvania courts. Now, though Rush remained busy, he still found it increasingly difficult to make ends meet. As his biographer Powell notes, quote, as long as he remained in his native city, all he could see ahead was a mounting burden, and the city bar, dominated as it was by a few older, well-established members who got all of the large fees, offered slight prospect of ever being able to meet his obligations by the returns he could earn as a Philadelphia lawyer. Mm. And so this speaks to, you know, there was already this established legal circle in Philadelphia. It was the, you know, it was one of the largest cities of the nation. And so in addition to even being Dr. Benjamin Rush's son, it was still hard to break in. And Philadelphia was an expensive city.
Yeah, it's interesting that even with his father's connections, right, that it didn't serve him any easier time trying to get into that old boys network, for lack of better phrasing. So very, very fascinating.
But those connections could still come in handy because maybe he couldn't break into the legal establishment in Philadelphia. But again, this was somebody who knew the person who was Secretary of State and by this point was President of the United States, James Madison. Thus, in November 1811, an offer came in from the Madison administration for Richard Rush to assume the office of Comptroller of the Treasury to replace Gabriel Duvall, who the president had nominated to the Supreme Court. Now, Rush's biographer Powell notes that Madison and Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin, saw an opportunity with Duvall vacating the post to find someone who could work better with Gallatin, as well as potentially consolidate support in Pennsylvania for the administration, because they realized that they were in a dead heat with the anti-administration faction in the Keystone State. So this was a point, and especially this time, so this is November 1811. 1812 is a presidential election year.
Yeah.
They need Pennsylvania to win. And so why not bring in somebody with those close connections? You know, he has not only his father, but apparently has established this relationship with the governor. So this would be somebody good to have on hand, not just for treasury business, but also to be able to get word back and share information with them. Who are the movers and shakers? Who do we need to have on our side?
Yeah. And had Gallatin and Rush worked together before? Like, because you had mentioned that the idea was that Rush might work better with Gallatin.
So I didn't find anything where they had worked like directly together, but it's, you know, in those political circles, they kind of know one another. And also yeah. With Duvall was more of the anti-administration faction. Mm-hmm. And so this is the time, you know, you have Samuel Smith, you have Robert Smith, you have that group in Washington, and Duvall was associated with them. And so they kind of kicked him up to the Supreme Court to get him out of the Treasury Department to make sure they could get somebody who was pro-administration in.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So here we go. He is headed to the national stage because on November 22nd, 1811, Madison signed a commission for Richard Rush to become the new Comptroller of the Treasury. Now, Rush did hesitate a little bit, but he agreed to assume the post after a visit to Washington to discuss the opportunity with Madison, Secretary of State James Monroe, Gallatin, and others. But this move was opposed by his father, Dr. Rush, who felt, quote, the humble office of comptroller could not compare with the respectable and professional office of Attorney General of Pennsylvania, and he pleaded with his son not to accept the post.
That's rough. Going against your dad. Yeah. And I guess I can see where what he's talking about, right? Here you have this really established statewide position, and you're going to kind of be a pencil pusher in a sense, right? It's not it's not really a cabinet secretary position. It's kind of lower rung. But to Rush's credit, I guess, he's entering the national stage in a different way and making national connections, which sounds like was his ultimate goal. So
exactly. And that's the thing. It really, and it's interesting, and especially the fact that he was replacing somebody who ended up on the Supreme Court, and that was controversial. It's like you're choosing the comptroller of the treasury over, you know, at that point, the attorney general was passed over. He could have been considered for this position, but they chose the comptroller of the treasury, which, again, political maneuvering. They were trying to get him out of the office and so kicked him upstairs. But again, you kind of see, like you were saying, Dr. Rush's point, you know, yeah, you're going to the national level, but how visible and how much gravitas is this really going to bring you to where you want to be? But Richard thought, he's like, this is an opportunity not only to get to that level, but also to get a handle on his finances. Because, yeah, you know, comptroller of the treasury, you're going to have a lot of work to do. So you're at least going to get a good compensation. And you're going to be in Washington, D.C. There aren't going to be as many parties and things like that. So maybe expenses will be less. So
maybe.
Maybe. So he did resign as Pennsylvania State Attorney General on December 30th and moved to the nation's capital. Now, Rush started his tenure in Washington in rented lodgings, but he quickly discovered that this was a city in name only. As described by Powell, Washington, quote, was a damp, muddy little city with wonderful ambitions.
Yeah, D.C. took a long time to kind of get together and get its act together. So, yeah, I can only imagine what it looked like when he arrived.
Yes. And so, you know, he gets there, he's on the ground, he's like, maybe my family shouldn't be here. It's kind of muddy and swampy. So,
especially coming from Philadelphia, right? Like a city that had time to develop and grow and to really be modernized, and going from that to DC, I can imagine was quite the culture shock.
Exactly. And so his wife, Catherine, and their young son, Ben, stayed with his in-laws in Maryland. So luckily they at least had family on her side closer, so he could go and visit, but still be in DC and do what he needed to do. Now, Rush suffered from illness the first few months there, attributable to, quote, trudging back and forth to his engagements in the winter dampness. But again, from Powell, quote, he learned the fine art of living healthily in the mire and cold, or heat and dust, of the great Serbonian bog around which the nation's capital was sketchily deployed.
I love these descriptions.
I was going to say, that is top-notch description right there. Oh my gosh.
Basically, he got sick because it was a swamp and was nasty, but he finally figured it out.
Yep.
He figured out how not to die in the swamp. As for the office itself, it, quote, made excessive demands on Rush's time and was confining in its routine. Now, it was up to Rush to coordinate what was happening with Treasury officials across the nation. All of the other offices in the Treasury, quote, depended on the comptroller for the warrants necessary before they could discharge their obligations and for the communications with agents of the department in other regions, whether collectors, assessors, or enforcement officers. In addition, he had to countersign all warrants drawn by the secretary, enforce the tax laws, prosecute suits for the department. He was the officer who determined the policy of the department on technical matters of financial administration, how accounts were to be kept, how settled, how monies were to be collected, and how dispersed.
Wow, that's a lot.
That is a lot more than that side gig as state attorney general.
Yeah. And just the kind of the influence and the power, right? Having to coordinate through with all of the other treasurers throughout the country. That's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah. But it was an office that was suited to someone from a legal background, as Rush served, quote, not only as a prosecutor, but also a quasi-judicial interpreter of the law, whose rulings had the uncertain but highly important status of administrative decisions. So it's really interesting, even though he doesn't come from like a treasury or monetary banking background, it does seem like this role is something that, you know, is suited to his background. And it was needed because he was coming into office when we were about to go to war. And of course, the Treasury would play a large role in terms of funding the anticipated war effort.
Yeah.
Further, Rush was entering the Treasury Department under attack. Congress had recently narrowly voted to deny a new charter to the Bank of the United States, which had been in existence for 20 years and had in its time proved a crucial instrument in the burgeoning national economy. Now, of course, Rush's new boss, Gallatin, had advocated for the continuance of the bank, despite the fact that the Democratic-Republican faction that he was a key leader of had argued against the bank since its inception. But Gallatin was saying, you know, even though he was on record in the past as arguing against the bank, when he got into office, he realized, no, this really is something good. We really do need this.
A lesson that the United States had to learn the hard way.
They were determined to learn the hard way. And the vote against a new charter was seen by Gallatin and others as being a strong statement against the Treasury Secretary. And we see the debates at the time and what folks were saying about Gallatin. And it really was, it was about the bank, but also it was about Gallatin. There was strong opposition to him within the party. And so this was a low time for Gallatin. He was starting to wonder, you know, do I really need to continue in office? I don't seem to be able to get anything done anymore. So this was a weird situation for Rush to come into this new role in. But Rush did work closely with Gallatin to facilitate loans being issued to help to pay for the war expenditures. And though the loans were not as successful in bringing in revenue as the government might have hoped, no blame is associated to Rush in this failure. So they kept on issuing these loans, these bonds, and they wouldn't get the full subscription. And then they'd have to go back and offer more generous terms, you know, a higher interest rate, being able to pay less on the dollar for these. It was just, it was a bad situation. And it only, you know, as we're going to talk about when we talk about other secretaries of the Treasury under Madison, it only gets worse from there. But Rush was a fervent supporter of subscribing to the war effort, even prior to a formal declaration. Rush pointed out when the first loan campaign, which aimed to net $11 million, only brought in $6 million, that it was still the largest amount raised by the U.S. government by a loan issuance to date. In comparison, a loan offer in 1796, which aimed to raise $5 million, had only brought in $80,000. So, comparatively speaking, it wasn't what they wanted, but you're saying
still massively successful, all things considered.
Absolutely. Yeah. But again, it's just, it's a bad situation all around. It just, everything's increasingly looking more tumultuous. This early troubled time in the federal government would help Rush to see things from a national stance rather than just from the Pennsylvania perspective. And Rush would soon become acquainted with leaders in Washington. He would take up a tradition of penning anonymous political articles using a pseudonym drawn from antiquity during this time, and as noted by Powell, quote, his importance in the administration quickly outdistanced the political importance of the comptroller's office. So he's starting to prove himself not just as somebody who's a functionary in the Treasury Department, but as a key political ally. And as the war neared, Rush would, in late May 1812, put forward a proposal that James Monroe be commissioned as a lieutenant general to take charge of American forces in the field, with his place as head of the State Department being taken up by none other than former President Thomas Jefferson. And this is just, it's one of those things, and, you know, I'm working on the Madison presidency series and talking about this now. And it's like, you know, it's just odd for us to think of asking a former president to become Secretary of State.
Right. Right.
But at the time, you know, Madison was only the fourth president. There wasn't this established precedent for what a post-presidency looked like. And so it wasn't completely out of the realm of possibility. And indeed, Madison and Monroe looked at this idea and they're like, that really is a good idea. And so they tossed it around a while. Eventually, nothing came of it, but it's just interesting that they considered it and that the idea originated with Rush.
Well, and this was a time, too, where it had happened before, so that a former president had kind of come out of retirement, right? Because Washington, after his presidency for a little bit, helped command an army. So I can see why this wasn't completely outside the bounds of possibility. So still interesting, especially when you consider like today's politics, but that's not our job. Our job is not to look at today's politics and try to make it make sense.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the thing, like that would develop over time. But I also discussed this in the narrative series. You know, at the time, there was a former British prime minister who was part of the cabinet in the British government. So from the examples that they knew of, it wasn't necessarily completely unheard of. And to your point, Alicia, that Washington semi came out of retirement. We won't talk about that Hamilton was really running the show, but whatever.
But at least in name only.
In name only, he did come out of retirement. So it wasn't that completely unheard of. But meanwhile, the close relationship that Rush developed with Gallatin would prove beneficial in the example that Gallatin provided. Powell describes Gallatin as, quote, resolute but wise, and never failed to see the full picture of a national issue. He can anticipate objections and opposition. He could furnish answers in terms of his theories of government. He was as near a philosopher as American politics could offer. And so this would be an example that Rush would carry forward. Now, in his early days at the Treasury, Rush was still heavily involved in Pennsylvania politics. And as we talked about, probably with the encouragement of the administration, keep your fingers on what's going on the pulse of Pennsylvania politics. He would write to state leaders and did what he could to influence appointments and motions from afar. And so, again, with that presidential election coming up, this was a key place for him to be in. And again, beyond the scope of his office, this was him proving to be a key political ally within the administration. In the midst of the political and bureaucratic tumult in the lead up to the War of 1812, Rush also had family matters to consider, as his wife Catherine was dealing with, quote, a prolonged pregnancy, which sadly concluded with a stillborn birth.
Mm-mm.
He also increasingly faced pressure from his father, Dr. Rush, to abandon the Madison administration and instead return to Philadelphia to seek election to a state office. So this is interesting. And again, like there's so much going on, but then also these family matters. And as children have faced, even in the present day, you know, having those parents, well, I'd really like you closer to home. Can't you just do something here?
Right. Is it so his father, was he just, it sounds like he's not a fan of the Madison administration. And so he's like, no, just come back. Because even in his short tenure, he made a name for himself. Mm. So it's weird that Dr. Rush is still like, no, come back.
Yeah, and you have to wonder how much of it was politics and how much of it was very personal. Because, you know, especially where they had lived right next to one another, it does seem like they had a close relationship. And now having a son off, and at that point, communication, transportation was so, it was difficult to keep in close contact or to go and visit somebody. And so, and we see this with other figures. We saw this like with the Adamses, when they would travel far, they would be worried about the kids. They would be worried about, am I ever going to see so-and-so again? And so
right,
you have to imagine that some of that probably came into play. But Richard defended his decisions to his father, asserting that his financial situation was improving due to the salary from his treasury position. Of a return to office in Pennsylvania, he wrote, quote, Philadelphia I like, to Pennsylvania I belong, and trust always shall. But Philadelphia, as I had it, I do not crave again. And, let come what will, have steadily thought the decision right that took me away. So,
way to stand your ground, sir.
Absolutely. You know, and it's a very poignant thing. He's like, you know, I love it. It's always going to be my home, but I'm growing into something else. I'm going in another direction, and this just feels right. Though they would briefly come together when Richard was asked to deliver a speech at the 4th of July celebrations in Washington in 1812, and he turned to his father for inspiration and editing, the war and Richard's public support of it would split the two ever further apart. Dr. Rush was particularly upset when he learned that his son had written pro-administration and pro-war essays published in a newspaper in Philadelphia. While Richard, in his response to his father, quote, carefully avoided admitting that he had written the articles, he defended his right to do so with barely suppressed anger. And so those tensions, father and son, and they're just not seeing eye to eye on things. While not coming to a complete break, Benjamin and Richard Rush's relationship would not be the same as it had been previously. Richard's biographer Powell described the comptroller standing up for himself at this point as, quote, a little personal declaration of independence. Now,
That's an interesting comparison, but okay.
Well, and I will say that the Powell biography was an older biography. It's to date the only one that I know of that's been written on Richard Rush, and I would highly encourage anybody who's looking for a good project to take up a biography of Richard Rush, because there is so much out there, but you do get those interesting little nuggets in there. His own little personal declaration of independence.
Was it written in the 70s, the Powell biography?
It was actually, where's it at? I think it may be upstairs. I believe it was, I'm trying to remember. I think it was the 70s, because I believe it was around the bicentennial.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense, only because, you know, if you know that you're going to be publishing your book right around that time period, of course you're going to try to throw in the declaration. So
throw in the Declaration of Independence as much as you can. Now, you know, and again, this is like one of those stories that go through time, you know, frictions between parents and children. Sometimes there's reconciliation. Unfortunately, this time there wasn't that opportunity, because on April 19th, 1813, Dr. Benjamin Rush passed away. Again, from Powell, quote, he, i.e. Richard, had used his weekly letters to his father as a safety valve to discharge the excesses of enthusiasm, delight, or worry that he experienced in wartime Washington. And so, you know, they had this close relationship, and even though they were, you know, having frictions, it was still a close relationship. And so you imagine that this hit him hard.
Yeah. Well, and that's never easy to lose your parent, right? And especially someone that, like Dr. Rush, right? It seemed like he had a very outsized influence on his son. And, you know, to a certain extent, Rush went into public service and to politics in because of his father. So I can only imagine what that loss felt like.
Yes. Yes. But a mutual correspondent of both father and son would step into place as a surrogate safety valve for Rush, as the letters that the comptroller wrote to former President John Adams would increase after Dr. Rush's passing. In one of Adams's letters to the younger Rush, he exclaimed that, quote, in writing to you, I almost forget that I am not writing to your father. So it's nice that John Adams kind of, you know, and again, like John Adams, you know, as we've seen, for anybody who studied Adams and studied his post-presidency, he had all this time to reflect and take up this correspondence. And, you know, as friends like Dr. Rush passed away, he became very contemplative. And so it's interesting that in this point of grief, they were able to forge a stronger relationship and giving this kind of reassurance to this younger man that what he admired in his father, he kind of saw in the son.
Yeah. And you could do worse than having John Adams as your mentor. So
yes. You could do a lot worse. You know, somebody who chose Aaron Burr as their mentor may go a little astray.
A little bit.
But when word came to Washington in April 1813 that the Russian Tsar Alexander was willing to mediate in the conflict between the U.S. and Britain, President Madison appointed Secretary of the Treasury Albert Gallatin as a special envoy, along with U.S. Minister to Russia John Quincy Adams and Senator James A. Baird, to negotiate peace, as we discussed in Gallatin's episode. Now, Madison originally intended to leave Gallatin as Treasury Secretary while simultaneously appointing him as a peace commissioner, but the Senate decided that having a Treasury Secretary who was in Europe was probably not a good idea, especially in a time of war that we were desperately trying to figure out, how are we going to fund this thing? Might be good to have somebody in charge of the Treasury Department.
That's local.
Yeah. And, you know, we've seen other examples like, you know, when John Jay went on his mission to Britain, but at the time, the Supreme Court really didn't have much to do. But Treasury Secretary, that's always been kind of a big one. So,
oh, yeah.
Thus, on February 9th, 1814, they declared the office vacant to force Madison's hand to name a replacement. Now, Madison had put Secretary of the Navy William Jones in as acting secretary in Gallatin's absence, but the majority of the Senate felt that Jones should focus on the Navy and that someone should be dedicated to deal with the nation's finances.
Again, makes sense. You're in the middle of a war. You're trying to figure out how you're going to fund this, how you're going to continue the functions of government. You kind of don't want somebody splitting your time. So I got to side with Congress on this one. They made the right call.
Yeah, this is one of those times. Congress is right here. Madison, maybe just have a little rethink of this. We know you're confident in these people to be able to, you know, wear many hats, but not these hats.
Yeah.
So Rush at this point was talked about in political circles as a possibility to replace Gallatin. Makes sense. You know, second in charge. We've had that before. You know, we had Oliver Wolcott succeeded Alexander Hamilton. So we've seen this before. But Rush worked to dissuade such talk as, quote, he wanted to remain loyal in every respect to his chief, i.e. Gallatin, to succeed him in the place from which he had been so unceremoniously removed, would be to appear to condone the treatment the Senate had meted out. Also, you have to imagine, yeah, he kind of knows what's going on in the Treasury Department. I wouldn't be so eager to take that on either.
Valid point.
Yeah, I mean, he saw how much criticism Gallatin was getting. Who really wants to sign up for that? But luckily for Rush, the Treasury post was not the only one vacant at this point. As discussed in his episode, William Pinckney had vacated the position of Attorney General, and President Madison offered Rush the option of Secretary of the Treasury and Attorney General. Rush opted for the latter. Always good to have choices in these things.
I mean, yeah. Do you want to be the Attorney General? You want to be the heading of the Treasury, you choose. Must be nice.
I know, right? As the position of Attorney General offered nearly the same salary that he had gotten from his position at the Treasury Department, and as described by Powell, quote, offered Rush a logical extension of the heavy burden of legal prosecutions that he had been carrying for more than a year anyway, and it enlarged his scope because he was going to be a cabinet member. On February 10th, 1814, Richard Rush assumed office as the 8th Attorney General of the United States.
The Battle of Waterloo was one of the most famous turning points in world history. But what happened next? My name's David Montgomery, and I'm the host of The Siecle, a history podcast that tackles exactly that. Join me as I cover France's overlooked century in between Napoleon and World War I. The Siecle, spelled S-I-E-C-L-E, is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and can be found wherever you get podcasts.
Now, fun fact here. At the age of 33 when he took office, Rush has the distinction of being, to date, the youngest person to assume the post of Attorney General. And just for context, because we always think of a young Attorney General being Bobby Kennedy, Kennedy was 35.
Oh, okay.
Now, it's interesting, and I went down a little rabbit hole here.
No.
There were actually, I know, right? Never happened. Never happened. Because I was just curious. I was like, okay, well, you know, how does this compare to other attorneys general that we've had in the series? There were actually a number of them in their 30s. So Cesare Rodney, who we covered, was 35 when he assumed office. The first attorney general, Edmund Randolph, was 36. Charles Lee was either 36 or 37. And William Bradford was 38. So that's quite a few people that were in their 30s as attorneys general.
Yeah. But I think, too, it's a product of the time, right? Because you were going to college at like 14. You were studying under a lawyer at 19. And so by like 22, you've already have this established career. Whereas like today, you get through law school 25, 26-ish, if you're lucky. So they already had a number of years of experience ahead of their predecessors, their successors.
Absolutely. Well, and I also wonder if it's kind of the nature of the office, because we do have other cabinet posts that people tend not to be quite that young, but the nature of the attorney general at the time, it was this part-time role. You could still have your own legal practice. And so for somebody who's up and coming and just looking for that side hustle, here you go. And you get to be a cabinet member at the same time. Yay.
Yeah.
But over a month after his assuming office, Attorney General Rush wrote to former President Adams informing him that the day after he took up his new post, he was appearing before the Supreme Court in a case representing the federal government, quote, without the least previous acquaintance with any of its business. There I have been, day in and day out, ever since, until last Thursday, blundering on in an agony of embarrassment and ignorance, doing the business of the court and not doing it. With Mr. Pinckney, the late Attorney General, for the most part as my prompter, but sometimes left awkwardly to stand upon my own legs, doing everything but wearing the fool's cap, and almost that. So he was kind of thrown into the deep end the first day. Oh, well, yeah. You've got a case that you're arguing before the Supreme Court. I got what now?
But, no pressure.
No pressure. You'll figure it out as you go along.
Oh, my gosh.
And so it's interesting, you know, we've seen with most of the attorneys general, it's been kind of this slow start, but Rush is thrown in and has to take off running. And so, as he told Adams, quote, I feel what an immense deal of law, history, literature, and everything else I must subdue before I can stand erect in this post, should I ever be able to do so. And as described by Powell, quote, he was plunged into a welter of private and public law cases, which were almost as new to him as they would have been to the youngest novice in the profession. Prize cases, hundreds of them new and old, courts martial, admiralty decisions, constitutional problems, suits in international law, these and a myriad of other matters he was suddenly called upon to master. Yikes.
Again, no pressure.
No pressure. I get the impression that he jumped from the frying pan into the fire here.
A little bit, just a little bit.
Now, in his appearances before the court, Rush was described as, quote, plain, simple, and direct in his arguments. And though he drew few crowds, he gained the respect of the bench. So this is a time that, you know, there are many lawyers that are just so bombastic and, you know, make such an impression that folks want to go and see him. He's not that, but in terms of his diligence, it seems like he's gaining the respect of the court. When the Supreme Court term ended, Rush was given a new task that would be described as, quote, his most notable achievement as Attorney General, because Rush was responsible for, quote, editing the first authentic collection of the federal statutes.
Oof.
So at this point, there had been court decisions made, there had been laws passed, but nobody had thought or taken the time to actually collect them.
It's just the details, right? It's just the details of the federal government. We don't care.
These little details. You know, and of course, folks have been saying for a while, we probably need to do this maybe tomorrow.
Yep.
And so before Rush and his partner in crime in this endeavor, Supreme Court Justice William Story, no one had actually taken up this task. Oof. But Rush and Story would write back and forth on the matter during the summer of 1814. And as noted by Powell, quote, Rush printed a brochure, which was approved by the government, and finally, late in the summer, two publishers in Philadelphia brought out at $15 a set of the five-volume edition of the Laws of the United States. So this is a notable legacy. You know, we finally can reference what the laws are that have been passed for the last 20 some odd years.
And did he maintain that, or was it just kind of a one and done situation?
At this point, it was a one and done, but I think that I don't think it took quite as long. And finally, they realized, oh, we need to update this on a regular basis. That may be a good thing.
And then did that fall on the Attorney General? Sorry, I know now I'm going down a rabbit hole. Did that fall to the Attorney General to do that as they served in future posts? Or did it just fall under their office and somebody like a clerk or something is like, okay, here's here now, figure out what's been passed in the last legislative session?
I haven't seen anything. I would imagine that the Attorney General would probably, and again, this is just my guesstimate here, you know, grains of salt at the ready. But I would imagine the Attorney General was probably consulted, but it probably ended up in the catch-all department of the State Department, at least at the beginning, to go ahead and put all this together. That's just my guess, but I could be.
That's a good educated guess.
I could be completely wrong. But the State Department did get everything that nobody else wanted to do. And this is definitely one of those things that nobody else obviously really wanted to do.
Yeah.
Now, Rush also involved himself in efforts to promote American manufacturers to aid the war effort and wrote a piece, quote, for the Boston Patriot newspaper on the law of treason and intercourse with the enemy in opposition to the anti-war efforts in New England. During his tenure as Attorney General, Rush would regularly attend cabinet meetings and participate in discussions on the war effort. And this is something that, you know, it's still hit or miss whether the Attorney General, how involved they are in the administration, but Rush takes the approach he's going to be heavily involved. At this early point in his cabinet career, Rush would also express his support for free trade over protectionism. Now, I say this because his viewpoint on this matter would change, and we'll see as we go along how much this changes. Other than encouraging efforts to defend the city, Rush would be a mere spectator to the events leading up to the burning of Washington, D.C. in August 1814. Rush would travel with President Madison and the other cabinet members to the camp at Old Fields, 8 miles east of Washington, on the evening of August 22nd, where they spent the evening with everyone on tenterhooks. You know, this, they're starting to gather the forces. They're hearing the British are coming. They're trying to get the troops prepared for the defense of Washington, but they don't know exactly when the attack's going to come. They don't know if they're ready. It's a tense situation. But in the morning, Madison and his cabinet reviewed the troops and then returned to Washington. When they returned, Rush went to Secretary of War John Armstrong's home on the morning of the 24th to get a report on the situation. Needless to say, it was not good because the British troops were on the move towards D.C. Madison had already made his way back to the Army headquarters by the Navy Yard, leading into town. Rush followed soon behind him with Secretary of the Navy William Jones arriving at about the same time, and they participated in a council of war which concluded with the general issuing orders for the force to march to Bladensburg. Afterwards, Madison asked Rush to accompany him to the nearby Marine barracks to check on matters there before making their way to Bladensburg. Madison felt that he should be on hand during the upcoming battle in case Secretary of War Armstrong and General Winder ended up in a dispute, which, if you haven't listened to Armstrong's Seat at the Table episode yet, you'll understand why this was a real possibility, because Secretary of War Armstrong argued with everybody, especially generals, because Armstrong knew better than everybody.
Of course he did.
When it was clear that the battle was lost, Rush accompanied President Madison back to Washington, where they found First Lady Dolly Madison waiting for them near the Navy Yard. Then they proceeded to the president's mansion to gather up what they could. Then Madison, Rush, and Navy Secretary Jones walked down to the river and, quote, climbed in a boat and were conveyed to the Virginia shore. This is just one of those moments, and it's been interesting going through the cabinet members that were there. You know, here you have the federal government fleeing from the nation's capital. The next couple of days would find the president and his party going from Virginia to Maryland, trying to find lodging amidst people angry at Madison for the disastrous British invasion. Finally, on the evening of August 27th, they returned to Washington, D.C. to find many of the public buildings, including the White House, the U.S. Capitol, the State War and Navy Department building, the Treasury Office, and more, destroyed by fire. Rush's home in Washington was thankfully unscathed, and he offered President Madison and his wife the use of it, but they opted to stay with Dolly Madison's sister and brother-in-law. Now, Rush did take in British Colonel William Thornton, who was the second in command of the enemy forces. Thornton had been injured and taken prisoner in the Battle of Bladensburg. So he's got the second in command of the British forces that just burned Washington, D.C. in his home. And the Rushes would nurse Thornton back to health. Now, this is, again, a tense situation. The president and his administration had to quickly come back together and prepare for the defense of Baltimore, which was the next target of the British invasion force. Due to his scandalous handling of the invasion, which you can learn more about in his episode, John Armstrong resigned as Secretary of War, and James Monroe succeeded him while also retaining his position as head of the State Department. Due to ill health, as we'll learn about in his episode, George Campbell resigned as Secretary of the Treasury and was replaced by Alexander J. Dallas. William Jones also asked to be relieved of his office at the Navy Department by the end of the year. We'll learn more about that in his episode. And he was ultimately replaced by Benjamin Crowninshield. Thus, as the difficult year of 1814 gave way to 1815, Richard Rush was the only cabinet member still left in the position that he had been in since at the beginning of the year. So this was a big year of cabinet transitions. And, you know, he's looking around, oh, there are a lot of new faces here. Hi, guys.
Well, you can imagine, right? Trying to navigate the country during a time of war was probably very taxing. So I can see why many of them said, okay, that's it. I'm good. Bye. Yeah,
exactly. And especially when you've got like John Armstrong that everybody is literally burning and hanging in effigy. Maybe it's time to go.
Yeah, that's my cue.
It's time. I'll go ahead and y'all got this, right? Now, in February 1815, Rush fell ill and was unable to participate in cabinet meetings or in the Supreme Court hearings during the term held during that time. He did finally start to recover in mid-March and set to work on some articles about the war, which were published anonymously in Philadelphia. He returned home to Philly in the summer, and his family stayed there for the remainder of the season when Rush went back to attend to matters in Washington. Indeed, Rush would be the only senior member of the administration in Washington during August and September, as Madison and the rest of the cabinet was away. As this was the time when news of Napoleon's 100 days came to the capital from Europe, Rush would be preoccupied in gathering information from Madison and dealing with foreign ministers, which, though outside of his scope of work as Attorney General, fell to him as he was the highest ranking executive official in the capital. So everybody leaves and they're like, can you water the plants? I'm sure everything's going to be fine. It should be nice and quiet. Maybe we'll have a delivery or two. And then all of a sudden, Napoleon is back. Things are chaotic in Europe. What is going on? I was just here to water the plants.
I feel like this is a theme of his career. He just keeps like hopping from like fire to fire to fire to fire. Poor guy.
Where did this emergency come from? Why is the house on fire? I'm just watering the plants.
I just write the checks, people. I'm not for foreign relations. I don't want to deal with treaties. I'm not trying to deal with a dictator or any leaders or any military guys. I just want to write the checks. Come on. Or at this point, he's just the lawyer. Excuse me. So I just want to argue my cases in front of the Supreme Court. I'm not ready to do any negotiations with other leaders.
My job before was writing the checks. Why are you put? Oh, they're not here anymore. Okay, I guess I'm writing the checks again and arguing the legal cases. And I've got a diplomat right here. And do we need to arm get the army mobilized? Oh my gosh, what am I doing here? Yeah.
Yes.
Because he also monitored affairs at the War and Navy departments as they shifted back to peacetime operations. In terms of legal matters, Rush somehow, in all of this, he found the opportunity to study more and reported his progress to former President Adams, as well as drafted an anonymous pamphlet on legal institutions entitled American Jurisprudence, which was published in September 1815. He makes a lot of things happen.
Yeah, he does. My God.
He is basically a one-man federal government, and he still has time to study, legal institutions and write pamphlets. Interesting.
You wonder if the man slept. Maybe he had an issue with insomnia.
Maybe that was it. Well, I mean, when you've got this much going on, it's going to be hard to sleep. So might as well just crank out a pamphlet in the middle of the night.
Sure, yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
Now, few prominent cases requiring the Attorney General's participation came before the Supreme Court in the 1816 and 1817 terms. So he was finally able to breathe a sigh of relief. Everybody came back to Washington, took over their posts. Like, okay, things are going smooth. Meanwhile, we're getting to 1816, which was yet another presidential election year. And so Rush joined Secretary of State Monroe in a trip back to Monroe's home in Albemarle County, Virginia, in the summer of 1816. And while in the area, Rush visited former President Jefferson at Monticello and President Madison at Montpelier. Now, this is one of those cases. So Rush claimed that the trip was for quote unquote health and recreation. Yeah, you probably can imagine there's probably a political motivation with this since Monroe was the Democratic Republican presidential candidate. Rush's biographer Powell notes that this trip, quote, cemented their, i.e. Monroe and Rush's personal relationship. So, they've both been in the cabinet for a while. They're, some of the longest lasting members still in the cabinet. And so they've had an opportunity to work together professionally, and this helps to grow their relationship. Powell also asserts that, quote, there are indications that he, i.e. Rush, had also made certain arrangements with Monroe. So naturally, Monroe won election, prepared for his inauguration. He wrote to Rush in early 1817, asking him to remain as Attorney General, as well as temporarily serve as Secretary of State until his nominee, John Quincy Adams, could return from his diplomatic service in Europe to take up that post. You've already basically been a one-man government. I mean, it's just the State Department.
It's the catch-all, right?
Yeah.
It's no big deal. It's not high pressure. It's not high stakes. It's a part-time gig, and the Attorney General's a part-time gig. So basically, two part-time gigs is one full-time gig. You're fine.
You can handle it. But then, after Monroe's inauguration, he departed from the nation's capital to undertake a four-month tour of the United States. With his absence from D.C., Rush was left as, quote, the temporary head of the executive department of the government again.
Oh, poor guy.
He needs to go ahead and get out of town before everybody else starts rushing off. He is left as the man holding everything.
All the bags.
Because, of course, you know, Secretary of the Treasury William Crawford and Secretary of the Navy Benjamin Crowninshield, who had also continued on from the Madison administration, were only in the capital city part of the time from March until September 1817. And a new Secretary of War had not been appointed since Crawford had vacated that office in October 1816. As noted by Powell, quote, as a result of the lack of permanent officials, little of importance could be achieved, but Rush found Monroe had left so much unfinished work at the State Department that he had all he could do keeping abreast of it.
Mm.
So, sounds like in that last year, Monroe was a bit preoccupied with that whole election thing, and he's like, yeah, I'll get around to the work later. Somebody's going to come in and take care of it.
Sounds like Jefferson on his way out.
I know, right?
Ah, the new guy will deal with it. I don't want to deal with it anymore. I'm over it.
I'll handle it. Powell described Rush's approach to his public work as follows. Quote, a rapid worker accustomed to spending 12 to 15 hours daily at his desk, he was methodical, precise, and apparently tireless. He had an orderly filing system. Every paper was neatly docketed and endorsed with a brief of its context. By dint of prodigious effort, Rush was able to keep the Attorney General's office going, to discharge the formalities of official receptions and conversations with foreign representatives, correspond frequently with the president, and run the State Department so vigorously that when Adams arrived, he found business much in arrear, but without any accumulation of it, since Mr. Rush has been at the head of the department.
That guy is efficient not to a fault, I guess, but that guy is just very efficient.
Yes. I mean, wow. He's proving you only really need one guy to run the government.
Jeez.
Rush also had to deal with the conclusion of negotiations that Monroe, in his previous role as Secretary of State, had begun with the new British minister to the U.S., Charles Bagehot, over the lingering question of naval armament on the Great Lakes. On April 28, 1817, Bagehot informed Rush that Monroe's proposals for limitations on naval vessels allowed on the lakes had been accepted, and thus they were able to conclude what's come to be known as the Rush-Bagehot Convention. A year later, Monroe put this agreement before the Senate, which ratified it, and thus it gained additional authority as a formal treaty between Britain and the U.S., which helped pave the way for what has remained a peaceful diplomatic relationship ever since, despite occasional contentious disputes flaring up. Indeed, the terms of this treaty would remain in effect for 124 years.
Holy moly.
So even though he wasn't necessarily involved in the initial negotiations, he was involved at the very end, making sure that things wrapped up, that they were able to get this treaty through.
Yeah.
He also concluded a treaty with Sweden, which Monroe had begun. So
he's the finisher.
He's the finisher. He's getting things done while everybody else is out and about, having fun, touring the nation, whatever. Rush has got it. Upon Adams's return stateside in August, news started getting out that Attorney General Richard Rush would be Monroe's choice to replace Adams as U.S. Minister to Britain. Adams arrived in Washington on September 20th and took charge of the State Department, and he and Rush spent the next month conferring on foreign relations and administration matters in general and on Rush's upcoming diplomatic mission in particular. Rush's instructions, quote, were general, containing no positive order for the minister other than to recur to the instructions given the commissioners at Ghent 3 years earlier. So basically his instructions were, let's just build on what happened in Ghent. Don't rock the boat. We want to maintain this peace. We've gone a couple of years without declaring war on Britain. Let's keep it that way. Rush had already started making preparations for his family to move to London and had them sent to Annapolis, Maryland to await departure. Now, Rush proposed to Monroe and Adams that he travel to London aboard the USS Franklin, which was a new frigate which had launched that year and was preparing for its shakedown cruise to the Mediterranean. At the time, this was rather unorthodox, because typically American diplomats who traveled abroad would make their own transportation plans upon private vessels. However, Adams, after Rush proposed this, he started to see this as an opportunity to display American naval strength to the British. We want to remain at peace with them, but we also want them to know we're not a pushover. And so ultimately, this plan was agreed to. Thus, Rush departed from Washington on November 6th and officially left office as Attorney General on November 12, 1817. The Franklin departed from Annapolis, Maryland on November 19th with Richard and Catherine Rush, along with their four children, a secretary, three servants, and a pet mockingbird aboard. I had to include that detail.
I hope the bird made it.
I hope it did too. Now, Powell summed up Rush's tenure as Attorney General as follows. Quote, "His career in the office was neither picturesque nor distinguished, but it was industrious, efficient, and generally satisfactory." So, doing pretty well so far.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we had talked about previously, long before he came into federal office, that the initial, you know, Dr. Rush had asked Madison if Richard could be sent abroad. I said it would take a while, and here we are. This journey from Maryland to England in late 1817 was Richard Rush's first experience at sea. But it seems like, for this journey at least, he managed to escape seasickness, even during a severe storm that the ship hit a few days out of port. Now, Rush spent the journey learning more about naval operations from the commander of the vessel and his crew. He was like, and again, like, this is Rush epitomized. He's like, well, I've got nothing to do. We're going. Let me learn about naval operations. Why not?
Of course.
of course.
A lifelong learner, that guy.
Lifelong learner. He is going to use every opportunity to learn. So they reached the English Channel on December 14th and anchored. However, apparently the order from the British government, quote, "to pass his baggage on diplomatic courtesy through the customs had not arrived, and thus the rushes were delayed as they tried to sort things out. Finally, except for a piece of luggage holding Rush's books, which was held, quote-unquote, as a bond, their luggage was released, and they were able to proceed to London." Now, I have to say, I would be rather upset if my bag full of books was being held hostage.
Yeah, I was just thinking that would make me very uncomfortable. No, you cannot have my books.
I can do without clothes. It's fine. I've got one pair on. It's fine. I'll last, but don't take my books.
Yeah, no. I think I would probably give up my china. Here, you can have the china. I don't need dishes. I will eat with my fingers.
Exactly. So that was an interesting detail. Now, sadly, Alicia, the mockingbird did pass away while en route.
Oh, bummer. I had a bad feeling. A bird, the air, the ship. That's not going to happen.
Now, everybody else, at least, on the evening of December 21st, arrived in London, and they had dinner with Rush's sister, who also lived in London. As described by Powell, quote, "everything was new to him. He had known only three or four cities well in his life thus far. None of these had prepared him for London. Tremendous in size, devoid, as he thought, of architectural beauty, planless, chaotic, and sprawling, it was of absorbing interest." Soon after his arrival, Rush would begin to keep a diary in which, quote, "several times a week, he would write long and detailed entries about his observations in the city, which would ultimately become the basis of a future publication, Memoranda of a Residence at the Court of London." So he is just taking all of this in. He's like, you know, just absorbing all of this, trying to get a sense of London and what all this meant and what was going on. And you have to imagine just how overwhelming this was, you know, even though he had, you know, grown up in Philadelphia, this is on a whole nother scale.
Yeah.
The new U.S. minister to Britain met with British Foreign Secretary Lord Castlereagh on December 23rd to announce its official assumption of the post. Despite Rush's fervent support of the War of 1812, he was equally enthusiastic about engaging the British government and the British people without a hint of resentment or lingering animosity. Powell noted Rush's, quote, intellectual sympathy with the English. Now, Rush would experience difficulty in setting up his house in London. Again, from Powell, quote, house hunting was a discouraging task in London. A minister had to live in the West End, maintain a certain state, be prepared to give dinners and receive calls, but Rush's salary was small, almost the smallest of any of the diplomatic corps, and he had no private means. Rents ran from £400 up to many thousand for the year. He finally managed to secure a home in a new part of London that other diplomats also resided in, but it would not come cheap. So this is, again, we're getting back to those financial problems. He's not in a good financial state. He's not getting a good salary. And now he's in this expensive city trying to support himself, his family, and the U.S. ministry.
Yeah.
On February 12, 1818, Rush was formally presented to the Prince Regent and prepared diligently for this new experience, catering to the less ostentatious approach that he learned through diplomatic circles the Prince Regent preferred. With this out of the way and with the reception going well, Rush could in earnest begin his mission. Again from Powell, quote, to the American minister, particularly if he were of a sociable turn and gracious manners, all the houses of London were open, from Buckingham Palace and Carlton House, where he had entree at the private doors, to those of the diplomatic corps, the cabinet members, the members of parliament, and, most interesting of all, those of the leaders of London's literary and intellectual world. So, again, you have to imagine just how overwhelming all of this was, all these noted leaders, not just in politics and diplomacy, but also literature and thinking and scholarship. All these doors are now open to him.
Yeah, it must have been a bit of a paradise for him, considering, again, lifelong learner, really interested in literature and history and the law. So I'm sure he was very happy.
This is Rush on cloud nine. Now, Rush's conversations in these social circles would range from opportunities for American merchants to trade in the Black Sea to a suggestion that the U.S. acquire an island in the Mediterranean. So this is just one of those times that, I mean, everybody's thinking of all these grandiose schemes. And again, he's in the midst of this. Rush would also have to answer for events across the Atlantic outside of his control, including Andrew Jackson's occupation of Spanish-owned Pensacola, despite the U.S. not being at war with Spain. And, of course, we will discuss that in much more detail in the future, in future episodes. Rush benefited from what Powell described as, quote, the changing opinion of America in educated circles of England. And so we've seen, like with previous U.S. ministers to Britain, that they were kind of seen as, you know, folks viewed America as kind of a backwater, as just, oh, well, these are just, you know, these uncouth people. And after the War of 1812, some of this starts to shift. And you also have to wonder how much Rush had an influence on that. Here you've got this guy who is from Philadelphia, well-educated, interested in so many different subjects, and how much did this impact their impressions of what America was and could be.
Right.
Yeah. Powell describes, quote, as a diplomat, Rush was an interesting contrast to both Adams and Gallatin. Rush was neither Back Bay Puritan nor urbane Genevan. but his plastic nature permitted him to combine the personal ease and gracious manners of Gallatin with the intense nationalism of Adams. And while he left no such impress upon the history of his times, though his career was equally long and busy as theirs, he was to accomplish some things that neither of his great contemporaries alone was able to do. Even in what, in the grand scheme of history, are minor parts of his role, Rush excelled from his more acclaimed predecessor in the role. So, you know, this is one of those times, and there's so much that's still to be worked out between Britain and the U.S. in the aftermath of the War of 1812. And, you know, you've got commercial interests, you've got personal interests, you've got national interests. And Rush, as we've seen, he's somebody who can take on all these things and more and get things done and make things happen. Rush's tenure as U.S. Minister to Britain was a breath of fresh air versus what the pre-war ministers to that nation had experienced. Quote, in the course of his first 12 months in London, Rush had no less than 13 fully planned interviews with Castlereagh, in addition to numerous conversations at dinners and on casual meetings. Nothing so perfectly reveals the new spirit Castlereagh brought to the settlement of the American relation than the quality of these conversations. Rush found everyone a helpful, pleasant discussion, the cumulative effect of which was not only to clear the air, but also to establish the best type of mutual regard. He focused his efforts initially on quote-unquote special proposals rather than larger initiative, realizing, likely correctly, that Rush needed to get some small wins under his belt, then build up from there. So he's being very strategic about this. And in this process, Rush proved himself an able partner. He was flexible and compromising when he could be, yet he provided a clear understanding and communication of where the line that could not be crossed was in order to manage expectations. Rush, as a diplomat, was all about establishing and maintaining mutual respect.
He was kind of put in that position at like the perfect time, right? Mm-hmm. He's a guy who is gonna learn and kind of sit back and then try to figure out a good way to effectuate the desires of both sides. So interesting that this was the time that he came in, right when the relationships were probably still strained and trying to rebuild that trust and that camaraderie and trying to come together to find a mutual tenable solution.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. This is one of those instances where it really does seem like the right person at the right mm-hmm. time, the right position. Because even though, you know, this was his first diplomatic foray, he didn't have those strong relationships. He was cultivating those. Of course, there would be some bumps in the road as things happened, but by and large, he was starting to build and rebuild this diplomatic relationship and try and forge a new path forward through establishing personal relationships with folks.
Yeah.
Now, throughout 1818, Rush worked with Castlereagh towards negotiations on a general diplomatic convention between the U.S. and Great Britain. And he was joined in London in August by U.S. Minister to France, Albert Gallatin, his old friend and mentor. Gallatin had been invited to the negotiations with the two British commissioners appointed by that government, including one who Gallatin knew from the negotiations at Ghent to end the War of 1812. So, you know, he's going to have Gallatin there to be able to help with negotiations. And this is an already established relationship that Gallatin has with one of the folks across the table. So this is a very good position and a promising position for them to be in. Starting on September 4th and continuing on for 6 weeks, the four diplomats worked, quote, to debate the 12 subjects before them. This agreement, dubbed the Convention of 1818, was signed on October 20th, and though it did not settle matters related to impressment and trade in the West Indies, Secretary of State Adams felt that it built on the Treaty of Ghent and that the agreement exceeded his expectations as it addressed disputes over fishing rights off the coast of Newfoundland, laid out the U.S.-Canadian border all the way to the Rocky Mountains, and established a temporary arrangement for a joint U.S.-British occupation of the Oregon Territory. So this...
That's pretty successful.
Yeah. This was a big deal, you know, and you know, as listeners of the podcast know, we've talked so long and so many times about how there would be these missions to Britain and they'd come back with little or nothing. But it was seen as, okay, well, you know, we really didn't deal with the big issues, but we got a couple of smaller things. Maybe we can build up. These are some big issues, and these things have been lingering out there for a bit, and they're able to achieve this agreement. It's not everything, but it's hitting some pretty key moments. And even Adams, who had literally been in his shoes as U.S. Minister to Britain, said, this is impressive. This is more than I expected.
Yeah. Well, and I think, too, it's that it's credit to Russia's relationship building and kind of making the compromises where he felt like he could kind of almost that he had this end goal in mind, the global picture of, okay, let me be very strategic as to how hard line I'm going to get. And, you know, I know the United States and Britain during this time period, you know, Britain was never really going to give them what they wanted. And it was always kind of this stalemate of, no, we're going to keep things kind of status quo. And so, yeah, I think it's a huge accomplishment for Rush to be able to get even the inches of what he was able to get. So, yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Shortly after the conclusion of this agreement, Rush would find himself on the receiving end of the British government's ire because Andrew Jackson was up to his old tricks again. In this case, they were upset about Jackson's extralegal execution of two British citizens, Alexander Arbuthnot and Robert Ambrister, in Spanish Florida. He's still roaming around Spanish-held territory, causing mischief and threatening international relations. Jackson, we're going to be talking.
Jackson.
We're going to be talking about him for a while. Now, the thing was, you know, this was difficult. It was putting Rush in a very difficult position, and especially not really knowing where the administration was, not having really official guidance on this. And this was just a really precarious time diplomatically. But Rush would manage, because he saw his role as, quote, to convince the British ministry of the justice of the affair and encourage at the same time the attitude of non-intervention, which had been urged by Castlereagh at a recent European conference at Aix-la-Chapelle. He would succeed so much in this task that, quote, when the House of Representatives in Washington conducted its investigation and speeches denouncing Jackson were published in full in the London journals, Castlereagh was put in the faintly ridiculous position of defending the execution of two Britishers by an American general, while Americans themselves condemned it.
Huh.
He managed to convince Castlereagh, you know what? He really was right in executing them.
Now that is a talent.
Yes.
Wow. I thought for sure that there's no way, because, well, Jackson overstepped. Jackson was Jackson.
Yeah.
And so, wow, that's a plug for his legal skills, again, for that relationship building that he was able to not only kind of avoid, right, yet another diplomatic incident of tensions and kind of dissipating the anger to, yeah, no, it was actually really justified. So
exactly. You know, this is the guy. If you're trying to sell something, he's probably the guy to do it.
Yeah,
he'll make it happen. But eventually all this subsided, you know, as we'll talk about in the series, Florida ended up becoming part of the U.S., and so all this ended up just kind of fading away. In 1820, upon the death of British King George III and the ascension to the throne of his son, the former Prince Regent, Rush, along with the other foreign diplomats stationed in London, had to present their letters of credence to the new king. George IV remarked of Rush that he, quote, had been always in the spirit of conciliation since I had been at his court. and that there were occasions when the exercise of such a spirit had been useful and acceptable to this government. So Rush is being seen as somebody very, you know, that they can work with, a good partner, somebody who's got this respect in London.
Yeah.
However, in the aftermath of the convention of 1818, there wasn't much need for Rush to meet with the British Foreign Secretary with the same frequency as he had in the lead up to the negotiations, and Rush noted how he felt a gulf was forming between the aims of the European powers and the United States. And so you really had like this intense first couple of years, but then, and it's in the midst of like this post-Napoleonic War euphoria. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, Europe is being completely realigned. Folks are trying to figure this out. It seems like a new world. But once this new European system began to settle into place, Powell identified the rest of Russia's tenure as, quote, a new period in which the forces within each nation pulled in opposite directions, and for the theme of world peace, substituted a new pattern of conflicting national interests. After a period of exhaustion and confusion, a welcome period of recuperation, there began the old game of power politics, increased in tension and tempo as each nation recovered its old ambitions or reasserted new. So this new world order is forming, and Rush is kind of feeling like, well, where does America really fit into this? They're concerned about European affairs again. Of course, Rush kept pushing the issues. He kept pressing on issues like the West Indies trade. But sadly, one of the key figures in Rush's diplomatic tenure in London was lost in 1822 as British Foreign Secretary Lord Castlereagh died by suicide on August 12th. Oof. A frequent rival of Castlereagh's, George Canning, would succeed him in his post. But as noted by Powell, quote, it was clear to the American minister that the candid, direct, matter-of-fact Castlereagh had been replaced by a much more colorful but much more wily man, of whom it was said that he could hardly take his tea without a stratagem. Again, I love Powell's descriptions.
Yeah, this guy, he's an amazing writer. My God.
Yes. And quote, the actual degree of difference between Castlereagh and Canning on foreign policy appears now to have been much less than their contemporaries thought it, but so great was the difference in personality that the whole emphasis seemed to shift. Richard and Catherine Rush also faced personal challenges and loss during their years in London. Two of their daughters passed away while Rush was serving abroad, and Catherine suffered from bouts of ill health. Further, living abroad put strains on Rush's already delicate personal financial situation. So this is, you know, this is not one of those good times for him. You know, he's had so many years that it seemed like things were going in the right direction, things were moving, and now we're getting into this phase where it's just, you've got this dark cloud. And likewise, you know, he engaged in negotiations with British commissioners. They really weren't able to come to large agreements anymore. He did engage in some negotiations in late January 1824 that lasted until July 28th, in which they reached an agreement on the issue of the slave trade, but they made no progress on other matters despite hours upon hours of meetings. And even the convention that they reached on the slave trade would not be ratified by the U.S. Senate, where the vote on the treaty split along sectional lines. So, you know, even the little that he's able to achieve diplomatically, going back to Washington and nope, not happening.
Yeah.
Another of Rush's activities in London related to the issue of slavery as well. Rush was an active member of the American Colonization Society, which was an individual that worked to free Black individuals from slavery with the caveat that they would relocate back to Africa. Now, for his part, Rush saw slavery as a threat to the nation's development and saw the American Colonization Society as the best means by which to end the peculiar institution. Now, you know, this is one of the things with the ACS. It's like it's not taking into account Black individuals were born and raised in the U.S. And in some cases, their families had been in the U.S. for generations. Why would they want to go to a place that they had no knowledge of, they had no connections to, was generations removed from them? And so naturally, this cause did not gain much traction.
Yeah, the ACS is always a problematic moment, right? Because on one hand, it's wonderful that they believed that slavery was, you know, evil and needed an end, and that Black people needed to be free. But then there's that condescension and that patronizing attitude of like, but you can't live here. You have to live somewhere else, despite the fact that, you know, some of Black Americans, right, were here longer than some of the other members of society. So I know I've always been fascinated with ACS, and I get it. I appreciate Rush's sentiment, but also understanding it and contextualizing it in the time, it doesn't necessarily surprise me that he's a member of ACS.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. It really gets to this idea of the United States being a white nation, and these people, this group, they aren't Americans. Yeah, they are. Right. They are just as American as you. And especially, you know, we've seen in the series cabinet members who immigrated to the U.S. And meanwhile, you have Black Americans who have been in the U.S. for generations, but they're not seen as being American. They're still African. Yeah. So that'll be something that we can discuss as we get to the end and go through our categories to discuss his legacy. But I wanted to point out this is something that he was involved with. Now, between his increasing frustration at not being able to make much progress with the British government as he had in his initial years of his tenure, and the strain that he had, you know, in terms of personal finances, you know, just everything, you see these increasing frustrations. After 7 years in London, Rush made it clear that he was anticipating leaving his post before much longer, and 1824 provided the perfect opportunity for him to do so, because that was a presidential election year. And Richard Rush is, if he is nothing else, he is one to take advantage of a presidential election to change his role.
Yep.
And this was the election, you know, Monroe had served 2 terms. But as Rush wrote to Monroe, quote, "I've remained here much longer than I ever expected when I came away. And now, with your approbation, it is my intention to stay here until the close of your executive term," because, of course, James Monroe was going to retire. And Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, who, of course, had developed a close working relationship with Rush during his tenure as U.S. Minister to Britain, they were in direct communication back and forth for all these years. Adams was the natural successor to Monroe, and Adams indicated to Rush that he intended for him to have a place in his cabinet should he be elected. Now, as I'm sure our audience is aware, the election of 1824 was not a simple one. In the end, with 4 candidates on the ballot, no one candidate got a majority of the electoral votes, and thus the election was thrown into the U.S. House of Representatives to decide between the top 3 candidates. Now, it did help that the 4th candidate was Speaker of the House Henry Clay, who was eliminated from contention, and that Clay did not like Andrew Jackson, and that William Crawford, who was the 3rd in this mix, had unfortunately suffered a stroke and was seen as not being able to fulfill the duties of the office. Thus, it came out that Adams would ultimately be chosen in February 1825 to be the 6th U.S. president. Now, because of this delay in the choice of Monroe's successor, it wasn't until April that Rush received an invitation from Adams to serve as his Secretary of the Treasury. Naturally, he accepted the post and spent the next few weeks wrapping up his official business in London, as well as making arrangements for him and his family to return to the United States. And after presenting his official letter of recall to King George IV, Richard Rush and his family left London in May 1825, boarded a packet to New York City, and made their way home. And so, Alicia, this is the first time in this series. We've had cabinet members that have moved directly from one office to the other, but this is the first time that we have a former cabinet member having that kind of interregnum and then coming back to the cabinet in another administration. So back to the cabinet for Rush it is. And it's a post that he was rather familiar with, Secretary of the Treasury, under better circumstances than he was initially offered the post.
Less stressful.
There's still so much more to talk about with Richard Rush. So I hope you'll join us for part two of the Seat at the Table episode, where we discuss his tenure as Secretary of the Treasury under John Quincy Adams and his later life and career before we evaluate his overall legacy. Special thanks to Alicia from Civics and Coffee for joining me for this episode. And while you're waiting for Rush Part 2 to come out, be sure to check out Civics and Coffee wherever you get your podcast. I'll have a link to Alicia's webpage on my site, which is presidenciespodcast.com. There you can find past episodes of the podcast, links to more information about all the U.S. presidents, and ways that you, yes, you, dear listener, can support the podcast. You can become a patron of the podcast at patreon.com/presidencies and enjoy all of the perks that our patrons get, including an ad-free podcast feed. If you're not ready to contribute monthly, but would like to send a one-time donation, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/presidencies and buy me a coffee, or three, or 10. I also have a book wish list linked on the website of titles that would be great to have for research for upcoming episodes. If you'd like a free way to show your support, please take a moment to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, Good Pods, or on my website. It helps to get the word out there about why folks should be listening to Presidencies. Thanks so much to everyone who shares information about Presidencies on social media or by word of mouth. If you're not connected to me by social media already, I can be found on Facebook, Mastodon, Post, and Blue Sky as Presidencies, on the formerly known as Twitter at Presidencies89, and on Instagram and Threads as Presidencies Podcast. You can also send any questions or comments you have, or just a quick hello via email to presidenciespodcast@gmail.com. Last, but certainly not least, I thank you so much for listening. Until next time, stay safe and healthy, be kind to one another, and take care, dear friends.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th-century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th-century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.